My name's Claire Press, and I'm Vogue Australia's sustainability editor. You're listening to Wardrobe Crisis, the podcast that unzips fashion's issues.
Do you mind if I move the microphone? I need to lounge.
Devotion, darling. Shadow. I think as humans, we are major forces to be also reckoned with. And I think creativity always flourishes when there is any type of crisis.
That's been the absolute pleasure, is watching talented people who have skills far and beyond mine come together and work collectively.
Einstein always said, nature has all the answers. Just look to nature, it has all the answers.
Just because I happen to be able to source them easiest, I guess, I was buying original wool jackets from the 1950s. I was buying them at Portobello Market. And a one man's rubbish is another man's gold.
For me, it was about age. It was about the attitude of people. And it's about how they're wearing the clothes, why they're wearing the clothes, and capturing a bit of their wisdom and empowering people to look at aging differently.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes to how they impact on the environment to the politics of personal style, we are so hot right now. This is the second in our mini-series of three episodes that sheds light in different ways on the issue of modern slavery. It's another cracker of an interview, this time with the much-loved London-based fair trade fashion pioneer Safia Minney. If only all fashion supply chains were fair trade. The Global Slavery Index 2018, published by the Walk Free Foundation, identifies fashion as one of five key industries implicated in modern slavery. In Australia, every year we import over $4 billion US dollars worth of clothes and accessories at risk of being tainted by modern slavery. But as I mentioned in last week's show, about 40 million people globally are trapped in this heinous phenomenon that encompasses not just bonded or forced labour, but debt bondage, forced marriage and trafficking into many industries, including the sex trade. Overall, 71% of modern slaves are women. So this is a feminist issue across the board. This episode is brought to you by Liminal Apparel, a fair trade producer of blank clothing and accessories. And blank means merch or promotional t-shirts, hoodies or other clothing. They also make uniforms and things like aprons and tote bags and wristbands. All the stuff that companies can buy blank and then add their own branding. Liminal works with an NGO called Freeset to produce out of India. And Freeset began in the Sonagachi red light district of Kolkata, and the aim was to provide alternative work opportunities and freedom for women and girls there, but also to strengthen communities through skills-based training so that in future, girls are less likely to be trafficked into the sex industry. I reached out to Liminal because I know how much they care about this issue of modern slavery and about getting these stories out there. And they're my mates. I first met them when I was talking on a panel in Melbourne. And that's where I learnt about the significant blind spot in ethical and sustainable apparel that is blanks. I just never even heard of blanks, have you? But because they're unbranded and because some of this stuff, when conventionally produced, so just think about that promo t-shirt, is basically designed to throw away and often made very cheaply and often made without much transparency because of the lack of branding. But Liminal and their new venture Common Good turn this whole story around completely. They make beautiful, cool and responsibly produced gear using GOTS certified organic cotton, and they're all fair trade audited. So this stuff is good, but it also does good. It's a social enterprise. So if you're looking for blanks, whether it's clothing or tote bags, I reckon this is where you should go. And you can find them at liminal.org.au, and that's liminal.org.au, and also at www.common-good.world. And actually, Liminal produced the promo totes for Safia Minney's Slave to Fashion project, so that's a lovely tie-in. We recorded this conversation in London at Safia's head offices, from which she does quite a few different things. You no doubt know her from Peopletree, the fair trade fashion business that she began in the early 90s. In 2015, I think, she stepped down as chief executive at Peopletree, although she's still involved, but she's also now heading up this fair trade shoe brand called Pozu, and we'll hear all about that. Safia is in Andrew Morgan's doco, which I'm sure you've all seen. It's called The True Cost. And she's an MBE. She's an activist. She's spoken more than once at the World Economic Forum's meeting in Davos. So that's pretty impressive. Like, once is impressive. Come on. She's the author of four books, including Naked Fashion, Slow Fashion, and Slave to Fashion. And that last one explores fashion's uncomfortable relationship with modern slavery. And it was released on International Women's Day in 2017 as a campaign. So it had videos as well as the written word. The idea behind Slave to Fashion was to profile best practice brands and designers to prove that slave-free fashion is achievable and that fashion can be used to empower workers. You can find out more at safiamini.com, and that's SAFIA-MINI. As always, dear listeners, thank you for lending me your ears. Do get in touch. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Mrs. Press, and I do so love to hear from you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and our listeners, Safia Mini. I know that so many of our listeners love you. I've already had loads of Instagram messages going, she's my hero.
How sweet.
I want to just begin by talking about words. So you have said that you're not mad keen on the phrase ethical fashion, that is quite hard to pin down and define. You're all about fair trade. Do you want to talk to me a little bit about that, and also to define fair trade for us, just to begin with?
I think certainly back in the day, starting Peopletree, our model was really very much about fair trade. And that was about working with the most economically marginalized people in the so-called developing world, which meant going into rural villages, working with farmers, helping them to go organic. So being able to source and build the first supply chains in organic and fair trade cotton, and going into village-based artisanal groups that put gender and environment central to what they do. And, you know, to be honest, ethical, or the term ethical fashion, doesn't cover that. Fair trade does. You know, fair trade is a, I hate to use old development language, but it's a pro-poor agenda, development campaign. You know, it is really about making trade work in the most beneficial way for the people that most need it. Ethical trade is incredibly important. It's about actually doing the common sense thing. It's about delivering basic human rights in factories. It's about sticking to environmental laws that we should all, we've all, our governments have signed up to adhere to them, but sadly do not happen. So whilst ethical trade should be the norm, you know, I really think we should be going beyond and above ethical trade. We should be going to a fair trade agenda, which is really about empowering the most economically marginalised people through our fashion.
And also ethical fashion, even though I've always not loved it as a phrase because it's a bit clunky, it's now a buzzword, so it becomes something people adopt that maybe they're not necessarily following through at every level.
Yeah, I guess that's true as well. But I think, you know, certainly the first kind of ethical consumption model, which was, you know, very early 90s for those of us old enough to know.
That's you know, me. Was
Nah, not you.
Yes. But I remember the Naomi Klein no sweatshops issue. And you know what? We're still there.
Yeah. But
20 years later.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a, yeah, we are still there. And unfortunately, you know, the ethical meant it was, you know, a whole gamut of different issues, from organic to animal rights to upcycling, recycling, you know, green energy. I mean, it just covered a huge area of topics, which, of course, you know,
we need
organic and recycle, very much living within the heart of ethical fashion today. But I think that, yeah, it's a fabulous term. You know, I feel like I've actually caved in. I've kind of lost the battle. I'm calling it ethical fashion, but my heart is definitely about fair trade fashion.
I read that in the beginning you spend a lot of time trying to decipher fairer than what.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think at the time, you know, This is 20 years back, looking at fashion. You know, what I had to do is I had to understand what was going on in the supply chain. So I spent a lot of time going into factories, going into slums, meeting with garment factory workers and finding out what working for a conventional brand actually looked like. What were they having to put up with on a day-to-day basis? And, you know, I'd sit in their tiny room, sometimes the size of your or my bathroom, watching them queue in a hallway where they might cook rice and some simple vegetable or dal, standing in a queue behind 20 other people that we were waiting to do the same thing without even half a day to do their laundry every week. I mean, and I think that's what gave me the motivation. It also helped me to understand what a fair trade model could actually deliver that was so different.
That's the key question. How can fair trade improve the lives of producers? And also, how can it be good business?
Okay, well, that's two very, yeah, very big questions. Okay,
I guess so let's start with how can it improve lives?
Yeah, so how fair trade fashion can improve lives is that it can create livelihoods and income in rural areas. So it basically, by having a job, it means that families are kept together. It means that the money then is going into local projects like schools, healthcare. You know, businesses then flourish because if you've got, you know, 200 hand weaving women then spending money in local shops, you know, you have a whole local economy that is then strong. It has a voice. And very often it's just that, you know, it's the urban elite setting the agenda in big cities, in big towns, and the rural poor simply don't have that voice. So, you know, a strong economy allows for political participation. It allows for a policy that actually stands for women and stands for people that live in rural areas. But keeping families together has really been a key for me. And when you look at the kinds of countries where, for example, PeopleTree are working, and POZU too now.
And those countries are?
India, Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, for example. You know, what you're looking at is women often having, you know, very, very poor rights. What fair trade can do is it can positively discriminate against women getting work at equal pay, giving them the opportunities to really use their work to open bank accounts, to improve their family, to rebuild their homes, to really, you know, learn and develop their voice to be able to speak out for the rights that they need to deliver social change in their villages. And I think, you know, for me, that's really what it's about. That's what fashion should be and can be.
That is what fashion should be, my goodness. Or that is what fashion production should be. I want to just mention the World Fair Trade Organization and their 10 fair trade standards. And you talk there about the first one, which is creating opportunities for economically disadvantaged producers. I want to ask you how exactly you go about doing that. And let's talk about with regards to POZU. So first of all, for those listeners who know you for PeopleTree and might not be aware of this shoe brand that you're now leading, can you tell us what that is?
Sure. Well, I joined Sven Segal, the founder of POZU, about a year and a half ago. And I think what we realised with this fantastic opportunity for not only the mainline collection, but also for the Star Wars licensing collection that we have.
I can't believe you did that.
I know,
it's cool.
It's utterly bonkers. It's just fantastic.
But it's cool for, sorry to go off track, but it's cool for something that's not a giant big mega brand.
Yeah.
To be able to do a collab like that.
Absolutely. I mean, to have something like, you know, the Han Solo sneaker and the Falcon sneaker and then this amazing line that we've developed for mainline as well. It's bonkers great. You know, inorganic cotton, in fair trade rubber. It's great. Yeah, so joining the brand, you know, it was really this question of, okay, how do we really spread the opportunity for an ethical sneaker? Because there are the big brands out there like Vans and Converse, and we would really like to be, you know, the go-to brand, but we weren't able to compete on price point. And so what we've done is we've built up the Sri Lankan supply chain, so using natural coir, which is the, you know, the hair of the coconut, the fibre of the coconut, as a foot mattress. Then we've got fair trade rubber, and then organic cotton uppers for the shoes, screen printed in a really great factory. And I think for me, it was basically coming to a country where I've worked with before, Sri Lanka in this case, but in the craft sector, a little bit in textile, you know, using my experience working with Sven and the team, because whilst I have textile experience, you know, making shoes is a completely different area and one that I'm relatively new to, and designing some fantastic collections that are now available on our website.
So how does the way you make those shoes empower communities?
I think the first thing is that the sustainable materials that we're sourcing ensure that a fair wage is being paid and a premium to, for example, the rubber tappers. So an hour and a half down the road, there's a community of about 400 people that are, through the benefits of fair trade rubber, getting a premium to build bridges, clean water, developing loans, for example, for their community as well.
Can you just explain very briefly how those premiums work for people who aren't aware of the fair trade model?
Sure, yeah. The way that fair trade premiums work is that on every pair of shoes that we sell, a bit of money goes back to the community that the community then decide how they're going to spend.
Self-determined.
Yeah, really important.
And
grassroots
local.
Up. Exactly, exactly. So talking to the rubber tappers a couple of months ago, for example, the problem that they faced was that they had a river kind of cutting through the forest area, which meant that women were going more than an hour and a half to kind of come to work. They're going around it to get over this river. And so they decided that they wanted to spend part of the premium on building a bridge.
Wowee.
So, you know, it saves time. It meant that, you know, collecting water from a safe well was much quicker. It reduces carrying. It means that they can also, they have a much more comfortable life.
Let's talk about shoes, because I write and talk and find out so much stuff about ethical fashion. I'm thinking about apparel and clothes. I think we actually talk less about shoes, and I certainly know less about the negative impacts on people and planet of shoe production. I read on your website this crazy stat that on average, 3 pairs of shoes per person end up in landfill every year.
Yes, it's really quite horrible, isn't it?
And then I thought, it's me, because I put in my husband's grotty trainers in the wheelie bin because I don't know how to recycle them.
Yes, and they're often a very complicated combination of different synthetic materials, which mean stripping them out and actually being able to recycle parts of them are very, very difficult, if at all. So yes, I think that is a huge problem. I think in the True Cost movie, there was a little section about leather tanneries and the huge impact that has to workers' health in those workshops and villages. Horrible, absolutely disgraceful.
Have you been there? So I'm thinking about around the River Ganges in Kanpur in India.
I've been in similar tanneries just to basically to witness them.
Fairer than what?
In Bangladesh, yes, but not actually to Kanpur. But having said that, you know, I think using chromium-free leather is something that the brand's always had close to its heart. We're trying to now switch out of leather and develop more inorganic cotton and pineapple leaf fiber, for example, because, you know, those are alternatives. Having said that, we haven't yet got to the point where we've found a strong enough alternative to leather. And I've never felt comfortable, having done ethical fashion or fair trade fashion for the last 25 years, of using plastic shoes.
PVC, I mean,
it's utterly mad. I mean, if we look at the microfiber and plastic debate now, you know, clearly it isn't an alternative to leather.
Actually, I just went to the V&A, to the Fashion from Nature exhibition, and they were showcasing new leather alternatives grown in labs, derived from mushrooms. But I thought this was so interesting. They had an ancient is the wrong word, but they had a very odd Victorian lacy handkerchief and then part of a dress that was made from pineapple fibre. And I thought they just invented that.
How
lovely.
Yes, and I think it's about...
Not leathery, woven.
These alternatives do exist and they have existed in the past. The question is how to commercialise these things. So I'm going to go and see Susanna Lee in New York, who's doing various exciting things with...
She's amazing.
Yes, I'm looking forward to meeting her face-to-face.
Well, she's growing...
Exactly.
In the lab, if we even use the word growing. She's developing. It's future
in
the lab.
So these are coming through, aren't they?
You mentioned that it has been so far difficult to scale and commercialise some of these fabrics. Let's just talk about the question I raised before and my double question, which was, what are the business opportunities for fair trade and how can we make it work? Do you want to talk about triple bottom line economics?
Yes, I think it's much...
Like the way I learned that phrase? Never heard of it before. I was like, make a note.
It's a good phrase. Yeah, so triple bottom line, what does it mean? Well, it means that you make a profit, but you also deliver social impact and you deliver something that is protecting the environment So triple bottom line, people, planet and profit. And of course, up until now, most fashion manufacturers, retailers have only been preoccupied with profit and profit at any cost. And that's actually the issue, isn't it? So I think, you know, when I started doing fair trade fashion more than 2 decades ago, you know, we were actually developing the first fair trade and organic supply chains in cotton, setting out what the standards might look like in terms of craft and manufacture. We were also developing the market and the kind of thinking and awareness around why fair trade and ethical fashion was necessary. So doing a lot of media work, TV documentaries, made about 6, you know, wrote about 9 books, you know, and of course, you know, building up with friends and influencers like your good self, you know, a place where we can talk and we can create and galvanize consumer interest, because civil society changes everything. So I think the costs of that have been tremendous. I've been very lucky in working with very, very committed teams of people in the past and now that want to change that thinking. But clearly it's an expensive thing. I think with today's designers coming at ethical fashion, you know, we have initiatives like Ethical Fashion Forums, new initiative, Common Objective, COs, linking, you know, suppliers with buyers, which I think is a really brilliant one. We have Sustainable Angle, which means that you can procure sustainable materials, which really create a lot of opportunity in terms of design.
And it's getting much easier for young designers as well to access these things, although it's still not entirely easy. I do get asked often by students, how can we get Pinatex or how can we get mushroom leather? I don't think it's quite so easy when you're a student. But
yes,
certainly with
true.
mid-range brands, it's easier than it was.
Yes, I think Offset Warehouse are another alternative for smaller quantities. But certainly the minimum order quantities for designers is a big issue.
But it costs more to produce if you're paying higher wages and if you're using better quality fabrics. But what are the benefits for business? Because I think the risk of not doing good business and of causing negative impacts on people and planet are coming to the fore now, and people are realizing that's bad business. That's not going to win us customers.
I think there's a very strong business case that you can make for sustainable fashion, aside from good risk management, which of course now is has become a debate with the UK Modern Slavery Act, certainly in terms of customer engagement, in terms of employee engagement, even investor engagement. We're finding that people are much more open to working with sustainability innovators.
Mm. You mentioned the Modern Slavery Act. I want to talk about Slave to Fashion, which you launched last year on International Women's Day. It's a book and it's a platform and it's activism and it's fab. Well
Thank
done.
You.
Love. Can you tell us about that project?
Slave to Fashion was very much an excitement around the Modern Slavery Act, which came into being in the UK in 2015. And many of us who have worked with NGOs and trade unions and fair trade groups and then, you know, back in the Japanese fashion market or the British fashion market, European fashion market, we were just like, oh my God, you know, the term modern slavery is actually being used to describe all of the things that we have been used to, all of the social entrepreneurs have seen in terms of child labour, in terms of forced labour, excessive overtime, bonded labour. You know, suddenly there became a flag that we had felt was terribly old-fashioned to describe a modern phenomena, the thing that is actually keeping millions and millions of people down. And I think for me it was about being able to find and to use my network to bring the stories of slaves out to the fore, so that the book covers stories about bonded, from in fact bonded labourers, women who have been also moved through human trafficking into either garment factories or into prostitution. Child labourers, for example, as well, were able to tell their story in its pages. But like everything, I find it important to really look at positive change. And so we were looking again at new types of platforms, for example, digital and otherwise, where workers are using their cell phones. Now, cell phone prices have really come right down to kind of $30. You know, how they're using their mobile phones to communicate and tell the story about injustice themselves.
It's actually amazing how technology has changed that game, isn't it?
Right. I think it really is. It's so empowering. And so this idea of people to people communication and trade becomes something that we can all be part of. Having said that, you know, there have been tremendous movements in the terms of accountability and transparency. The kind of social dialogue that many big brands have engaged with has been, I think, revolutionary. It doesn't go far enough. No. The modern slavery reports are... Yes. Yeah, so modern slavery reports still can be very much a kind of cut and paste job. I know that within the government here and some of the cross-party peers, again, we're looking at new types of initiative that can take the information and really make it much more consumer-friendly, which would also have the knock-on effect of meaning that we could hold brands more accountable.
I'm going to see the Baroness Lola Young this afternoon, so that would be a companion episode to this, because she's working on amendments to the Modern Slavery Act because she believes it doesn't go far enough. But Safia, the numbers are astronomical. At the time that the Modern Slavery Act was passed in 2015 in Britain, and I should say we're going down that track in Australia right now, but at that time 71% of CEOs said that they suspected there was probably slavery in their supply chain. 71%. Can you tell us about fashion specifically as opposed to all companies? How rife is bonded labour and modern slavery in our world?
I think the stat now is 77%. And I think the reason why the percentage is higher is because people are, they're more aware that modern slavery is an issue and they've started to discuss it. And that's the battle, really, that one needs to work through to deliver genuine change. Well, that's the beginning of it. So modern slavery is sadly the norm within fashion manufacture. I'm still looking at buying practice that means that, for example, despite the Rana Plaza building collapse and a lot of very positive health and safety legislation around building work with the Accord, buyers have reduced their prices more than they were 2 years ago. They're asking for orders 3 or 4 days, which actually represents more than 10% more quickly than they were
really
2 years ago.
So
what this means is people are being pushed harder, they're being paid relatively less, the deal for workers is not improving. And we need to also be incredibly careful, because what we want is we want a living wage and we want proper freedom of association within the factory environment. It isn't enough for brands to say, okay, let's just introduce automation and robots. Clearly, what we need for workers is to acknowledge that with a global growing population, that everybody needs jobs with fair wages. And without that, development is not possible.
Do you think that we're in danger of, I mean, I just thought of this in terms of my own work, that because I like to always find a positive angle and say, look what's happening, we're doing this, we're moving towards this. We're in danger of saying, look over here at all the good stuff. I didn't know that figure had risen to 77%. Obviously, it's because people are being more transparent and looking more into their supply chains. But it's worse than we thought, not better.
No, I think it's... I don't see it as a negative. I see it as a positive. It's looking at the truth. And with that comes the ability then for good leaders to bring their teams through that process to really understand more about their supply chains, where the vulnerabilities are. Look, you know, 3 years ago, people wouldn't have been having discussions with factories about sexual harassment and discrimination in the workplace. And now we're seeing that many NGOs are working together with companies, both with buyers, brands, and with the local factories, to set up schemes and systems that are anonymous so that female workers can really genuinely report their instances of sexual harassment. So this is really new.
It's also really complex, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what we have to remember, that you can't just solve this stuff in one act of parliament. You know, we need so much work to be done by so many stakeholders.
Yes. I think giving workers a voice has been the issue, hasn't it? And people haven't recognised the huge power that men have over women, especially in the workplace. And we have Me Too campaign, of course, you know, in our so-called first world, we've only begun to scratch the surface of what that might look like in supply chains.
Yeah. You mentioned Rana Plaza. I wonder if you would just tell us how you reacted and what you did after that. I know you were on a plane, weren't you?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Actually, I was about to have a meeting that morning with one of the largest trade union leaders who just didn't show up for the meeting.
In Bangladesh?
In Bangladesh. And I was on a plane coming back thinking, my God, what's happened? And of course, getting home and learning about the news, it was, of course, shocking. We'd had instances like Tazarine and Spectrum years before, but something on that scale was just shocking. We started something called Rag Rage, which collected money for the trade union that we were working with so that they could distribute emergency relief to rice and other necessities, which we then went out and helped distribute. But, you know, for us, it was very much about telling the story also, because this was very early days. You know, we were protesting in Oxford Street with other organisations like War on Want, Clean Clothes Campaign. You know, people had locked themselves to the doors of Benetton because Benetton was refusing to accept responsibility.
Well, it took them weeks or even months, perhaps, to admit they were their labels.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. So I think, you know, it was a shock that certainly galvanised international media and consumers. But it also did something really powerful locally, which was that taxi drivers and you know, normal working people in Bangladesh and Delhi and, you know, they suddenly became very strong in their solidarity of people that were vulnerable. You know, they were outraged. And I think we sometimes forget the component of what happened in the places where these awful accidents and incidents have happened, the atrocities, and the local response was just absolutely phenomenal. So I think, you know, we're entering an age of business and lifestyle collaboration, one where local workers and their better trade unions and brands and consumers work together. You know, there's a huge amount, I think, that is happening at so many different levels. Making modern slavery a thing of the past is what we should all be doing. And I think we have lots of great opportunities to do that.
Let's talk about one of those great opportunities, but also great examples, Swallows. Could you tell us how that facility works in Bangladesh and how PeopleTree works with it, and just share us a bit about that? And you know why I know about it? Because I watched Emma Watson doing a bit of a video when you took her there in 2010.
Yes, when I took Emma to Swallows, we had a fantastic time. That was a project, a fair trade group that really embodied everything in terms of fair trade. It embodied craft skill, so hand weaving, hand embroidery. It embodied the strength of the women and the equality of the women and leadership of the women. And I think thirdly, this beautiful rural setting of Bangladesh.
Don't have to go to the city and leave your children 600 miles away.
The air is fresh. You know, people have their own kitchen gardens. They grow vegetables for that evening. You know, the kids walk to school and back again. And we built a daycare centre there as well, which is probably the first in Bangladesh. And I think PeopleTree's clothes, absolutely beautiful. Emma designed some really great pieces at Swallows that sold well. So I think a fantastic experience for her and also for the team at Swallows. So I think, you know, Swallows with PeopleTree, we were the first to get the fair trade manufacturer mark, to get fair trade guaranteed throughout the supply chain, which really kind of celebrated everything that is great about fair trade.
Before we finish, I want to go back to ask you how it all began. So first of all, where does this come from in you? Because you're so impassioned about social issues and you've worked so hard for so long. I mean, 25 years. I often speak to people who I think are veterans of ethical fashion who've been at it for 8 years. Where does it come from in you? Can we learn a little bit about Safia as a kid?
Gosh, my father was Indian Mauritian. He died when I was 7. And my mum, I think, well, she had 3 of us, I was the eldest, threw herself into social work, voluntary social work. And I think, you know, that gave me a very early experience in kind of global issues. You know, she was working to settle refugees in our hometown. And
Where did you grow up?
In Berkshire. Yes, and it's just 30 miles or so from London. And so what was really interesting is that we would be part of her work. We would learn about how you get secondhand furniture and build up a home and organise for kids to go to school or register with a doctor. And then she worked with people with mental illness. So again, you know, at the dinner table, you know, we would have people that were mentally unwell. But that was an incredible experience, I think, for me as a child, to really understand a little bit about global diversity, but also some of the issues that were challenges to people to live.
And also about community engagement. I mean, I'm not sure how many young children do experience that, different kinds of people from different kinds of backgrounds, and how you can interact with them in a meaningful and real way, you know, rather than, I don't know, as a kid you kind of get told, put some charity money in this envelope. It's just a completely different way of thinking.
I think it is, and I think families are genuinely changing and trying to use that as an opportunity to educate their children in global issues and to feel that sense of what a global citizen really is.
Weren't your grandparents publishers and bookshop owners?
Yes, that's right, on my mother's side.
A bit political.
Yes, they were a bit political. Yes, that's true. My father's side too, they were, my grandmother was a sugarcane worker. So I mean, I have to kind of caveat that, because growing up in Berkshire, there were only two families that were of colour. So I kind of grew up.
Oh, right, would have been super white there, wouldn't it?
Yeah, really. So I was kind of a coconut, you know, I was brown on the outside and white on the inside. I didn't really realise that as I was starting this fair trade journey, I was actually going back to my roots to visit people that were very much like the family, you know, back in Mauritius. You know, they lived in simple houses with corrugated roofs, and that's very much the kind of family that I came from. My father was educated, and he came to Europe to study and became a scientist. And so, you know, so I had that opportunity. But I think what is interesting is I think we all now are part of a global family, and we're becoming more and more in touch with those elements of ourselves that are in fact a big part of the community, of our responsibility when we're considering, you know, how we spend our money, how we shop, where we work, you know, all of those incredibly important considerations that actually define ourselves and our values and beliefs.
How did you get to Japan, and why? And via being a Gorillagram business owner? What? Is that true?
Well, it is. Yeah, I started work at 17. I didn't go to uni. And I was studying advertising and marketing whilst working at Creative Review magazine. And I rented a desk in a shared office for lunchtimes and evenings, where I started this tiny company, because, you know, it's full time, obviously, with the magazine. And, you know, it was basically this Gorillagram service that...
Which is what? Like a gorilla comes and knocks on your door and
it's bonkers. Yeah.
So, wearing a suit.
Yeah. So on Valentine's Day, you could buy from me. I put an ad in Private Eye, and the equivalent of kind of Time Out today. You could get a gorilla, so someone dressed up in a gorilla suit to deliver wine or roses or a cake. And, you know, listen, I had 120 deliveries, which doesn't sound like very much, but for a kind of 18-year-old, it was kind of impressive, you know. But managing the logistics of that was a nightmare. I had gorillas running around Heathrow Airport. It would never be allowed these days, right? You know, and the wards of hospitals and, you know, hysterical. God knows where. It was just completely bonkers. But anyway.
But that says something about you, Sophie, because that says that you think you can do anything. You know, that says if there's an idea, let's do it.
I guess it says let's just try it. Let's just try something new. But there is a kind of a fun side, I guess, which is part of the ethical side. And I think, you know, through both PeopleTree and through Pozu, it's been about, you know, making ethical fashion the best, the product with the most integrity, you know, fun and accessible, and just, I think that's so, so important. So, you know, we've spent a lot of energy over the last decades kind of, you know, with short films, with books, with media, with documentaries, you know, making campaigns and blogs truly accessible. So, you know, I really would hope that people would find, you know, PeopleTree or Pozu on social media and engage with it. And that would lead them on to kind of other elements of an ethical lifestyle. Because frankly, if it's not fun, it's not sustainable.
Love. You began in Japan, is that right? So why were you there? And can you tell us very briefly about just the beginning of PeopleTree?
Sure. So I went out to Japan with my husband at the time, and I started working. I was learning Japanese and then working for Amnesty International, and then started working in the first body shop in Japan
part-time. Anita Roddick, best person after you.
she's lovely.
That, like, it's such an interesting
great
business model.
Hug giver. Yeah,
great hug giver.
Yeah, she's just really, really super adorable. Yeah, she was really sweet. Anyway, what was exciting was just understanding that, you know, a Japanese woman, similar age to me, who knew the body shop model, who, you know, perhaps travelled in the UK and knew what at that time the body shop stood for, loved the concept. They truly wanted something that was non-animal tested, anti-vivisection, you know, a fair trade and natural product. And what was really exciting in Japan was that there was a very, very new concept to Japan at that time, you know, ethical consumerism, signing up to a petition, you know, with Amnesty International in store. That was absolutely unheard of. And yet there was this huge appetite for it, which was so exciting. And that's really what motivated me to start Global Village and then PeopleTree from it. So early days was very much, you know, in my home, my spoken Japanese was kind of okay, but obviously my phone Japanese was atrocious. So I had a couple of university students working with me. You know, they would do a lot of the important kind of phone calls. We would publish guides on organic living, vegan, vegetarian, how to recycle in English and Japanese. So, you know, kind of these early stage, you know, opportunities to really spread the word. And then from that, I started selling fair trade products and found very quickly that the product wasn't really suitable for the Japanese market. They wanted things that were really different in terms of quality and size. We needed more transparency behind the product. So from that, I really started developing relationships with fair trade groups in India and Bangladesh and Zimbabwe at the time.
I want to just finish up by asking about TrueCost, because TrueCost is phenomenal. Everywhere I go and I meet people who find out that I'm in sustainable and ethical fashion, they will say to me, oh, have you seen the TrueCost? There's another thing in Australia which is based on a British show, War on Waste. That's another one that people always go, wow. Sustainability, have you seen War on Waste? But yeah, it's interesting because, of course, I've seen TrueCost, but it's interesting because it travelled so much. It's often people's first entry into this conversation and it changes their thinking. It's amazing.
Yes.
You're in it? Yeah. Fab. I don't know what my question is. My question is, it's excellent. Please discuss.
Yeah. When I met Andrew Morgan, he was, I think he came to me through my book, Naked Fashion. He picked it up and then I connected him with a few people. And then he went away and did the Crowdcube fundraiser and or Kickstarter to raise the initial money for the film. And ashamedly, I didn't really get much involved with it because, you know, lots of people come to me and say, could you do this or that or the other? And then he came back and said, look, you know, I really think what you're doing is incredible. We need it to be part of this film and we'll follow four people around through the film. So we ended up spending about a year and a half together. We went out to Bangladesh and did a lot of filming work in Japan and the UK. And it was just the most exciting project and documentary, and really the documentary that personally I'd always very, very much wanted to make. And he did the most incredible job. And up until that point, you know, we'd done about five or six documentaries in Japan in Japanese, but never anything in English. And he and his team, the Michaels, were just phenomenal, you know, just great investigative journalists who are not shy, very, very well networked, and really managed to get such a broad number of issues, from the brutality of how workers and their trade unions and representatives are put down to the whole sustainability issue. You know, I think more than 10 million people worldwide have seen it.
10 million?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I want to give you a round of applause. I'm gonna. Thank you, Safi and Mini. Love that we got to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's getting hard. My parents feel that, and if I end you, I tell them all that they are wrong, because I love you.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that. Because the more people who switch on to ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne.
Because I love you. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell you we're okay. I won't admit that I am blind. My friends don't feel that I'm carrying us too. I tell them all that they are wrong. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.